listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. So this is a really fascinating book, thinking about what we outsource in our life. You know, over the years, I've watched friends who are partners in two-job families struggle to figure out child care. And reading Arlie Russell Hochschild's book, The Outsourced Self, reminded me how, when I was growing up, the proximity of my grandparents made childcare a much easier proposition. Not only were my grandparents always available, but they indulged us shamelessly with unlimited 7-Up and all the Popeye cartoons we wanted to watch. I think they made my parents' busy lives possible. The idea that basic rights of human private life are now for services for hire, has been creeping up on us, I think you'll all admit, for quite some time. Births can now be outsourced to surrogate mothers. Death can be outsourced to hospitals and funeral parlors. I was telling Arlie that when my father died in January of 1990 and I wanted to go sit with him, his body at the mortuary, I was informed by the funeral director, who finally relented, that my request was highly unusual. So as we outsource more of our private lives, asks Hochschild, are we also outsourcing our emotional attachment? Now, as Arlie Hochschild makes clear, market logic for such basics is deeply embedded in our culture. We're all very busy. We can hire help to take care of our children, to care for our parents, to scatter our parents' ashes. There are love coaches, dog walkers, and wedding planners. You probably don't even think about it anymore. You're less likely to meet your potential mate at your sister's wedding or your neighbor's potluck than through eHarmony.com. But what kind of a toll does outsourcing our private lives have on our culture, on our relationships with others, and on our sense of community? The Outsourced Self is a path-breaking look at the transformation of private life in our for-profit world. Arlie Russell Hochschild is the author of the best-selling books The Time Bind, The Second Shift, and The Managed Heart. She's a professor emerita of sociology at UC Berkeley and is widely considered one of the most influential sociologists of the 20th and 21st century. There's even a book on her work titled The Sociology of Arlie Hochschild that offers a look at Hochschildian sociology as practiced by those who have expanded and built on her ideas. She's not only an eminent sociologist, she's also a great storyteller, and The Outsourced Self, Intimate Life and Market Times will draw you in, I assure you, from the very first chapter. And in conversation with Arlie Russell Hochschild tonight, we're very honored to welcome Amy Parrish, one of our favorite interlocutors here at Aloud. Amy is a biological anthropologist, primatologist, and Darwinian feminist who was taught at USC on the gender studies, arts and lectures, and anthropology programs and departments since 1999. Dr. Parrish has been studying the world's captive population of bonobos for the last 20 years. She currently teaches courses at USC on love, marriage, and the experience of being a wife, and on the cultural impact of Darwin's theories. And in all of her research, she uses an evolutionary approach to shed light on the origins of human behavior. It should be a fascinating conversation. Please welcome Arlie Russell Hochschild and Amy Parrish. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise, for that wonderful introduction, and thank you to all of you for being here tonight and joining us for this conversation with Arlie. We thought we might start out tonight by having Arlie read an excerpt from the book that tells a little bit about why this subject is interesting to her and how she got into it and what the personal connection is. So, Arlie, could we start with that?
Yeah, well, I think we all have unusual members of our family, and I had mine. highly eccentric 90-something school teacher in Maine, rural Maine, and she taught children how to sing a song and hold a pencil in a one-room schoolhouse. And I remember her from summers in Maine, sort of part of the gaggle of relatives that met every summer. And she always would talk about the importance of just do. If there was a need that somebody had, you know, a neighbor fell sick or the barn fell down, you know, neighbors didn't think, gee, should I help? Should I not help? No, they just did. So she was a great believer in this. Not that she answered needs herself with such alacrity. Anyway, here is something I wrote that shows one thread of why I got drawn into the great journey that's behind this, surprising journey behind this book. Generations of townspeople learned from her how to hold a pencil, sing in unison, and line up at the door of a small wooden one-room schoolhouse that her mother before her had once attended and where she too had taught. Late in life, Elizabeth married a man who lived down the rut a piece, as they used to say in rural Maine, and was widowed 5 years later. Later in life, she inherited the family farm, moved into a white house she built after the farm burned down. This she let go to pot. Shingles dropped from the roof. Chipmunks hopped through a tear in the screen of an open front door, scampering toward a large open bag of seed by her chair. Fleas multiplied. Mice rustled in the corners of back rooms. Peanut butter jars held up the living room windows. Retired, alone, lame, and half deaf, she sat for years looking out the window onto the gently sloping pastures her ancestors had plowed over 200 years ago. When my parents were still alive, they would look in on her and tried to help as much as she would allow. That wasn't much. My father would walk down the hill from our house, a window pane under his arm, toolkit in hand, prepared to replace a broken garage window he'd noticed. "I don't need help," she'd crack her schoolteacherly voice like a whip. My father would patiently return, set aside the pane and tools, and wait for a next chance. But the frailer my aunt became, the more fiercely independent she wished to be. Then, one after another, my parents died, and it fell to me to keep an eye out for Elizabeth. And that's all I did at the beginning, keep an eye out. From the safe distance of San Francisco, I... you see where this is going. I followed my aunt's quirky life with affectionate interest and listened with great admiration to the lively accounts of the help her neighbors gave her. During summer vacations, we flew to Turner, Maine to stay in my parents' old house up the hill. A day or so after we arrived, I would walk down to Elizabeth's house, knock on the front door, and wait. Silence. I would knock on the window and call, "Elizabeth?" Silence. I would call out again, "Elizabeth, it's Arlie." Silence. Then a slight stir, a shuffle. After 5 minutes, she would press open a stuck door, limp out in frayed slippers, holding two worn lawn chairs. These we ceremoniously set up in the knee-high grass outside her front door. In those years, she almost never invited anyone into her house and always refused my offers to mow her lawn or plant flowers. The first step in a ritual of slowly conceded consent. "No, no, thank you," she'd say. Then ask with genuine interest how my year had gone. After a certain number of offers to help and refusals, she would be coaxed to dinner with my family up the hill. During winters, when we were gone, kindly elderly relatives and neighbors visited, recycled her bottles, and eventually took to feeding her lean cuisine dinners, paying her bills, and washing her hair. Despite the plethora of services that had begun to appear in rural Maine, the spirit of just do had not vanished. In February 1998, a fierce ice storm hit Turner. It buried cars, felled trees, frozen froze water pipes, knocked out the power, and so chilled the air in my aunt's small living room that sitting in her wingtip chair, Elizabeth could see her own breath. As the temperature dropped, my aunt donned a sweater, a coat, three pairs of socks, two caps, and in a paradoxical expression of independence and helplessness, went to bed, pulled up two blankets, and waited. Help came, a parade of kindly neighbors and touching acts of small-town kindness stocked her refrigerator, brought extra blankets, set up an electric generator, and placed flowers by her chair. Other elderly or disabled residents, more mobile or less stubborn than she, were moved with pets to cots set up in the town fire station. Volunteers served three hot meals a day until the crisis passed. It didn't occur to my aunt to calculate her neighbor's time, add in gas, and write out checks to her rescuers any more than it would have occurred to them. In truth, Elizabeth was loath to pay anyone for anything. But even so, it sat right with both her and them that her rescuers were kind, civic-minded townspeople and not professionals delivering skillful, friendly service. Then one summer morning, when fortunately we were still close by, Elizabeth awoke to discover she could not swallow. After a day of no food or drink, she could not rise from bed. A neighbor called Turner Rescue, the town ambulance service. A soft-spoken EMT named Ross emerged from the van, sat on a stool beside my aunt's bed in her living room, as he had from time to time for years, and asked, "Well, how'd you feel?" "Fine," came her reply. "Fine, really?" "Fine enough." "Fine enough how?" "Fine enough so that I don't have to leave here." After a half an hour of gentle, steady banter, Ross coaxed my aunt into the ambulance and drove her to a local hospital where a doctor discovered a hernia blocking her colon. If he didn't operate, he explained, she would die. He operated, and from this she, now 94, miraculously recovered. She was transferred to a convalescence home where she was helped to stand, lean on her walker, and haltingly walk. A month later, the doctor declared her well. She could stay in the convalescent home, but she could not stay in the convalescent home indefinitely. Given the doctor's assessment, she could not legally be released without round-the-clock care in place. As Elizabeth's nearest of kin, it fell to me to figure out what came next. My birthday classes started in a week. The two couples who had previously pitched in with shopping, paying bills, washing hair, could do no more. But Elizabeth, childless, lame, nearly blind, unable to drive, only wanted to sit in her wingback chair on her beloved hill and be, as she imagined, independent. "Would she move to San Francisco?" I asked. "I could find you a place we could visit." "No," she said, "just take me home." But at home, she had no thought of bringing in a person to care for her. Strangers in my house? No. And as for paying such a person? No. My Aunt Elizabeth had in mind an older world of just do. But I couldn't quit my family and job in California to care for her in Maine myself. I couldn't just do. I now faced a care crisis of my own. So I ventured alongside the people in this book out onto the market frontier.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think we hear a lot of murmurs in the audience because all of us can identify in some way with that recognition that we need to reach out into that public space and find a solution to some of the things that used to be family matters or clan matters or something that our elders could help us with. And you do a wonderful, fascinating job in the book of tracing how we now need help with everything from basically the cradle to the grave, or conception to the grave. So she, Arlie, outlines in the book the growing industry of surrogate motherhood, or I guess even before that, getting a wantologist to help you identify what you really want. You might really want a surrogate mother, so then, and then you need a nameologist to help you with the name. And then as the child grows, you need a party planner, you need a lice, what are they called, lice detector?
De-licer.
Person at some point. You need a party animator for bar mitzvahs and other major events to encourage the kids to participate in the activities. Potty trainer, of course. Yes, mm-hmm. I forgot the potty trainer. In your own life, of course, you need a myriad of love coaches, therapists, party planners yourself, professional mothers who can help you to manage your household. And then as you approach old age, you need people to help you with managed care, with nursing homes, with making those decisions, with visiting your relatives for you. And eventually you need a grave butler who will come to your grave after you've passed away and will groom the grave and make sure the headstone is shiny so that your grandkids don't have to do that, even though those very same people acknowledge that it would be a good skill for children to learn and important to their character. So it's a really fascinating. I think there's something in this book for everyone, but I know that, and then your personal experience is woven in through the story of Elizabeth, and maybe you could talk a little bit about how you did, what decisions you did make in terms of where your line was, what was acceptable in terms of market services, and
What was acceptable, you mean?
In terms of how you made your personal decisions about Aunt Elizabeth. And
Not to spill the total beans, but she ended up happy. And she ended up cared for with paid care. Mm. But, you know, I feel like this is an issue for us in a way that's different from what we've seen a century back. I feel like we're kind of a century back. You would have seen the elite, the upper class, hiring maids and raft of servants, and someone in a frilly collar and a uniform would bring in tea at 4 o'clock, and that would be the story. But the middle class wouldn't be doing this so much. What's happening now is, I think, a kind of a perfect storm. First of all, a full half of the labor force is made up of women. Women have, like you and me and most
probably
here, gone into the workplace so that we have real needs in the market. And this is a book that talks about the real needs we have. But as we go into the marketplace, we're finding ourselves in a kind of an everything for sale world, and the question becomes where we draw this line. So the perfect storm is, we've got new needs. The middle class, not just the elite, are the people with these needs, and laminated onto our practical needs, I think, is a kind of a social anxiety that has to do with the reshaping of the social class structure, you know, as the rich get richer and the poor get poorer and the middle class kind of is dipping. We're all a little anxious about how this is going to play out for us and our children. So there are new needs. There's a new lamination of anxiety that's very realistic, I think. It's based on things really happening. And together with another thing, there is a kind of a marginalization of alternative means of meeting those needs. Mm-hmm. So we're not looking at EOL time, just do communities, and that's not available. And for most of us, I don't think we're looking to look back to that. And this isn't a book of nostalgic retreat. It's looking at that as something we might revitalize, but in a modern way, but that's kind of not there. And public services aren't there. We're not living in Europe or Scandinavia where you would have paid parental leave and fantastic public schools and many services. So alternate routes toward meeting those needs are increasingly not available. And a third factor makes this a perfect storm, and that is the kind of the market zeitgeist that we live with today, that we've seen a privatization of prisons here in California, schools, we're seeing parks being privatized, excuse me, and libraries. And the common rhetoric is to say the market can do no wrong, the government can do no right. So in that zeitgeist, why not just continue it on and privatize private life? So I think those three things, the new needs, the kind of absence of alternatives to them, and the zeitgeist of the market, make this kind of a perfect storm so that we're all, and I think we're not talking about it, and I think we're confused. Mm-hmm. And I think what we do, and why this feels important to me, is that we're kind of getting used to living in an unbalanced world, and that it's unbalanced structurally, you know, in kind of major spheres of the world, and that's expressing itself in our personal lives. And I think we develop ways, very clever ways. I think we're brilliant adapters. We're not taking this thing lying down. I mean, we do find ways to keep personal life personal, but I think it's time for us to step back, take the long look, and see if we couldn't rebalance this thing.
And you make some great points in the book about how the market creates anxiety and stress, and then you need the market to help you deal with all the anxiety and stress, which then, you know, becomes a very circular situation. So it's really interesting.
You know, I just learned about something like that. I've been on this book tour, so kind of walking around, and I learned about a new service to find you friends. I thought, well, all right, that's interesting. That's good. Friends, good. So, but I was thinking if I were looking for a friend, I was in New York, and I was walking down the street, and everybody was on their cell phone. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't get any eye contact. Mm-hmm. Nobody was, I couldn't, you know, hi, without being the oddball, you just don't look at people. And I went to a park and sat down. Everybody was on their cell phone, smartphone, BlackBerry, no eye contact. I went to a restaurant. Everyone was on their BlackBerry. No eye contact. I was on my BlackBerry. No eye contact. So I was looking for a friend. You know, I wasn't going to find one. So there's this new business called socialsusan.com, and you can look it up. And what it says is, look, are you without friends? Sign up for pay, and you will get a very elect group, and it will be an efficient, quick method for getting friends with high ROI. You know what that is? Return on investment. And then you want to be there with other friends who are really motivated, right, to get friends. And so how do we know that they're motivated? Because they are paying money. That is how we know that they're motivated to be friends. And then at the end, for me, it was the cincher. It said, well, and if you want to sell something, what a great way. This will be a market. You can sort of join things, and you can market your wares with these other new real friends. So I thought, so this was kind of what you're talking about, yeah, of a takeaway, give back. Well, wait a minute, these two things are connected. And with the wantologist, it was the same thing. I thought I'd come to the end of the world when I ran into a woman who called herself a wantologist. She turned out to be very smart and doing really interesting work. As I say, this was surprise after surprise, but she helped a woman who wanted, who lived in a middle-sized house with a middle-sized garden, and who wanted a big house with a big garden. That's what she wanted. So the wantologist asked her, well,
what is it you want? And she said, a bigger house and a bigger garden. And then the wantologist asked a really interesting question. What do you imagine you would feel when you got what you wanted? Peaceful. Okay. So Socratic, where have you been that you felt peaceful? Apart from a bigger house and bigger garden. Well, walking along the ocean back and forth, the sound of the waves is very peaceful. Well, ocean is two hours away. Is there a place nearer by that gives you that same feeling of peace? Well, yes, turns out there's a little stream in a public park, and she feels peaceful there. Well, it ended up that the woman dedicated a room in her middle-sized house to lots of ferns and the sound of music, of water trickling, and she felt peace. So in a way, I thought, well, this is great. Good for her. It's a useful service. But then I thought, well, wait a minute. First, she's in a world of commodities and things that are telling her that she must have a bigger house. And on the one hand, and then she had to go to another service to get it undone. So do it over here and undo it over there. Either way, you're in a market. It's just, it's a paradox here. It's a centerless thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think throughout the book, you know, a lot of the people that you interviewed seemed to really feel that there was absolutely nothing wrong with going to an expert, and you should leave a lot in experts' hands, and why wouldn't you? And, you know, we're a society full of experts, and it's efficient, it's multitasking, you're going to get a better outcome. For instance, the poor dad who tried to avoid the party planner, and he thought, how hard can a five-year-old's birthday party be? Yeah. Maybe you'd like to tell a little bit about how that went for him, although maybe
okay. Yeah, and you know, if I had a 12-year-old who wasn't potty trained, I think I'd be one of the first on the phone. So, it's poignant. How much do we find emotional meaning in the small acts of daily life, mm-hmm. and that we define as personal? And of course that changes historically, but the ones we think are personal, how much meaning do we attach to them? Or do we say, no, you know what, I'm not attached to it, I'm going to give it someone else. There was a man who worked long hours, traveled a third of the time, had three daughters, the youngest of which was five, coming up for a birthday. And they lived in an upscale neighborhood where a lot of his daughter's playmates had parents who hired party planners. So most people thought, well, it's not a big deal. But he thought it was a big deal. That's silly, he said. Look, this is ridiculous. Look, I'm not with my kid that as much as I'd like to be. So why can't a person plan a kid's party? So I'm going to plan my daughter's party. So he sent out the invitations, he blew up the balloons, he put the tail on the donkey on the dining room wall, and then he figured that if it's a real party, you have to have an entertainer. But that's an idea he got from the party planners. So he thought, what would he do? He put on a 10-gallon hat and dressed up as Crocodile Dundee. And so there he found himself sitting in front of eight little five-year-olds kind of cross-legged on the pit floor, and he found himself stalking one way, stalking another, starting to tell the little girls about alligators and how they were different from crocodiles, and then he went on to kangaroos, and then from the kangaroos to koala bears, and then he ran out of things to say, and they started to fidget and look bored. And then, because they were so used to being organized and planned, chaos, they all fell apart. And so all the parents had to put down their glasses of white wine, come forward, and sort of organize things again. And in this disarray, a neighbor came forward and took him aside and said, Michael, get real. The experts know how to do this thing. They know what five-year-olds think is funny. And I was all along telling these stories. I tried to get as far into the details as I could because I was looking for where people did or didn't draw lines. And he didn't draw a line. He took defeat. He was humiliated. Gosh, it didn't work. Backfired. You're right. You know, the experts really know. I don't. And so it went on like that until I interviewed the daughter sometime later and asked her what she thought. She said this, well, you know, at first we were embarrassed, and then we thought it was hilarious. And now I think, what a lucky daughter I am to have a dad like that that just plunges in. So she drew the line differently. But where do we, what is that knowledge to know what, where your five-year-old's tickle bone is? You know, is that professional knowledge? Is that parents' knowledge? Whose knowledge is it? How attached are you to that becomes the kind of thing. The same thing goes for acts. And I was thinking of the woman that got on Match.com.
Yeah, I was just thinking about internet dating as well and how these girls are going to grow up and one out of five of them is going to marry somebody they met on the internet. And,
yes.
What a radical change that is. And it was so fascinating in your book, reading about women preparing to go into that world and getting all of this advice, being told what number they are on a scale of 1 to 10. And you're really being expected to accept that you're a six, and then you should be looking for other sixes. You know, yeah. And then the men kind of take you for granted, and then if it doesn't work out, they think, well, I'll just go get another six. And then they're totally astonished later that, wow, actually you were something special, and I can't just go get a six is not a six.
That's right. But that's right, exactly. And this amazing. Woman that was a really lovely person, like all the people in this book, both the professionals and the clients. This isn't about the loveliness of the people. It's about the story that they find themselves as part of. She, you know, was 49, lonely, didn't want to waste more time. It hadn't worked to get set up at a party. And she kind of, she hired a love coach to help her not make mistakes on Match.com. So it was sort of a double purchase thing. And she never met this love coach. He was in L.A., and she was in the East. So this was all by phone or internet. And she there was a whole way of thinking that went with this. It isn't just a question of should I hire someone or not, but what's the culture you find yourself in when you do hire someone? And he said, look, this is work.
Yeah.
You know, I know it's about romance, but you have to work at it. You know, put in your FaceTime. And then he said, so she said FaceTime, okay, I'm a hard worker, I'm an engineer, I know about that, okay? And then he said, and then you have to brand yourself. Brand, well, okay, you know, and it can't be fake. A brand has to be a piece of you that's real. You know,
but so, not too real. You know, go for the average, which I thought was interesting advice. Don't be too extreme in any direction. Average is going to be successful.
Yeah, you would think the market would be good for oddballs getting together, but no, that wasn't his line. brand. Okay, brand. And then, as you say, you're a one, you're six or a five on a 1 to 10 scale. And she said, okay, I'm in the market, world's largest love mall. I'm a six, I get it. He's trying to help me. It's a market. And so she kept saying yes, yes, yes. And then he said, be mindful of your ROI. Yes, okay. So she was going all these ways until it came to her involvement with Mr. Wrong, who turned out not to get along with her 12-year-old child, and after 6 months they broke up, which was, I think, a good thing, because when he went away, when he left, he said, you were so easy to find. I'm going to find someone just like you. Mm-hmm. And it was at that point she said, whoa, he's shopping, and I'm a box of cereal. and he wants to go and get the next box of cereal that's right next to the first box of cereal. I'm a commodity. What was this? So it's like they both went into this thinking, okay, Match.com is a tool for finding a human loving relationship, in which case a kind of gift exchange and a very different conception of human interaction takes place. But what happened was that the tool kind of became moved over and came to dominate the entire experience. She drew a line. He did not.
And it's interesting, too, because you apparently also need training in actually going into the wild, which is meeting in real life. So
yes.
dating in the wild.
Yes, that's right. That's what the pros call it.
Which is an anthropologist.
Yeah. It appealed to you.
Yeah. So I think about, you know, our history as a species. We spent about 1.8 million years living as a hunter-gatherer in a small social network, mutually dependent, right. Gifts being very important, the just-do attitude being crucial to our survival. And so in some ways, we're a highly cooperative, mutually dependent species. We're even really more similar to birds than we are to other primates in that regard, that it really does take a village to raise an infant. And then on the other hand, we do have this capacity to really strive for status and to consume and to compete. Mm-hmm. And so you see those threads throughout the book, the, you know, Harvard-trained MBA housewife who now considers herself to be the professional mother running the household but not actually doing any of the mothering. Mm-hmm. And part of that is, you know, her job is actually to maintain the status of the family.
Yes.
And you can't argue that that's not important. I mean, anthropologists have looked and shown that it's the high-status people who survive calamities. I mean, who got off the Titanic? Everybody in the first class? Mm-hmm. The women in the second class and nobody in the third class, right? So these mm-hmm. are the kinds of struggles that I think do endure and that are that we're still living with today, and we're just expanding the network in really interesting ways.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting that when I ask people what memories stood out for them, you know, that woman that you're referring to who was the most elite of all the women that people that I interviewed, and was managing multiple households and had a raft of students.
The yacht.
The yacht. bobbing up and down in the Mediterranean thing. All of this, it was, when I asked her what memories stand out, it was of a time that she spent all night in the emergency room giving comfort to a friend of hers whose daughter was critically injured. And so it wasn't when she got something, it wasn't the perfect wedding or the perfect occasion. It was not when she purchased something, it's when she gave something. That's what she lifted out as representing herself. And there were many cases like that.
Yeah, so that's a very enduring theme, that we're still looking for those connections.
And
so even in the most impersonal, sterile situations described in the book, everybody looks for a way to personalize it in some way, to be friends with your maid, or I don't know, look for the caregiver that has something in common with the aunt and can actually live happily, seemingly more than just the market relationship.
Oh, yes. One of the most, to me, poignant stories in the book is of a woman who was extremely close to her father, who was widowed, and they used to talk every day on the telephone and argue. One was a Democrat, she was a Democrat, her father was Republican, but just this wonderful kind of encounter ritualized that they had, and they just adored each other. And then one day he got a stroke. She described it as reverse Alzheimer's, where you remembered things he just couldn't feel, and it broke her heart, and she described to me, weeping, that it was just very difficult to be in his presence, and just not to be mad at him for letting this happen. Why couldn't it have been cancer? Why does it have to be your feelings? And very understandable, anguished kind of state she found herself in. And at this point, she found, she said, "You won't believe this, but I found myself desperate for an elder care worker, and I have a friend in New York." She was on the West Coast, a friend in New York who goes to get her nails done at a certain place, and the person who did her nails had a friend who was looking for a job.
In California.
That's right. So this was how she happened to hire a Nepalese caregiver who turned out to be wonderful with her father. And she said, "I hired this woman to love my father for me." Mm-hmm. And it worked. It worked because, how did it work, becomes very important. I think this is one of these ways that we unconsciously develop brilliantly to kind of make it work humanly. We attach our feelings in the way we want to. And what she, this caregiver, you know, would straighten his tie and comb his hair and take pride in that, love him in that kind of way. But the woman who hired the caregiver said, "This woman, Nora, is a friend of mine." And I said, "What kind of friend?" She said, "Well, she doesn't read the New York Times every day, and she hasn't read Ed Doctorow's latest book. But we talk, you know, and I can tell you the latest gossip from INS. You know, they're all trying to get citizenship, and they found things to share, and there was," she said, "we adopted each other." And so there was a great deal of effort that this woman put into really connecting respectfully and with the caregiver who could love her father the way she wished she could. So I think there are ways like that. That's at one, I think, very beautiful extreme. But there's another kind of extreme. A lot of people that I interview don't cook anymore, but they almost all got a new oven or remodeled the kitchen. And there was some kind of strange thing. I actually interviewed someone who sells real estate. She said that's the first room people want to go to is the kitchen. You know, that's the bedroom second, kitchen first. And it was something about, you know, the stove and the oven had to do with this primal sense of cooking, but people had given it up. So it's as if this had become, you know, a totem, a representative, you know, of what was missing in the time bind. I talk about the potential self that we have, you know, the hypothetical self we would be if only we had time. And
you made a similar point in when you were talking about people's elaborate weddings and how much energy and money they pour into them and having the professional planners, almost because the outcome is so uncertain. About 50% of them will fail, but at least you can have a successful wedding. And so just like you might never cook
last
on your stove, but you've got the Viking six top, you know, there. So
that's right.
Promise of that potential.
That's right.
I do think there's something really beautiful about being able to go through your friend's manicurist to find somebody on the other coast. I mean, it just really speaks to the endurance of female networks, and I think you called them intersecting female grapevines, which I really liked, because I do think that's something really ancient in our species, that females are able to collaborate and do things for the common good. Certainly in my work with bonobos, that's been true, and I really liked seeing that. And
do bonobos outsource?
That's an interesting question. They're certainly willing to take care of each other's babies and co-nurse and you know, back each other up in fights, even if you don't get paid back for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I suppose in some ways they're you know, they're certainly willing to just do, at least, if not outsource. But there was such a poignant
story with the women acting as surrogates in India, and you know they're being told that you know they're just a suitcase for this baby. They're not to have any emotional connection whatsoever, any kind of emotional reaction, and yet it's really impossible to accomplish that. And their disappointment that some of the couples don't even wait for them to wake up from the anesthesia to say thank you. They just take off with the baby, and I thought that also spoke to some deeper human. Longings for that connection and that recognition that you're something together.
That's right. As part of this book, I did go to what's probably the world's largest baby farm in Anand, Gujarat in India, northwestern India. And it is run according to the principle of efficiency, and really the head of the clinic wants it to be. She wants to be the Henry Ford of surrogacy. And she's gone a long way in that direction. There are three dormitories where surrogates are kept for 9 months, not allowed to have sexual intercourse with their husbands, lest they, as quality control, that they get any kind of infection. And they generally, for something like $3,000, will carry a baby to term. They meet the intended parents very briefly, speak with an interpreter, because intended parents don't speak Gujarati and surrogates don't speak English, for maybe half an hour. The surrogates usually are married and have children of their own, and what happens is that a fertilized egg from the intended couple, but this, the wife's egg and the husband's sperm, is implanted in her womb, and she carries the baby to term. She signs a contract, which she cannot read, and which doesn't promise her anything. It's unregulated. It's commercial. It's for profit, and it's unregulated, so that she's signing often a contract at the Ashanka clinic that doesn't say what happens if she dies. You know, is if there's she's carrying four babies or three, does she have any control over fetal reduction? In a number of cases, she didn't want that, but it happened anyway. And the question is, you know, how does she feel about the baby? This is what I felt very privileged to be able to ask them about. It was kind of, for me, very moving. These are very, very moving. And, you know, if you took just a market perspective at this, you could say, well, look, she needs the money. True. She really needs the money. This is not optional. They really need the money. And the intended couple really badly wants that child. So why, if it's good for the one, it's good for the other, they're together, they're making a transaction, why isn't that fine? I asked a lot of people about that, you know, and some took simply that perspective. And others said, yes, it's good for them to come together, but it matters how they come together, how this is done. And I'll give you two stories, one where it was done, I feel, very humanely, and one where I found it very sad. One Indian surrogate who was not part of the Ashanka clinic in Gujarat but was in Mumbai, and she said, I'm very glad that I did this. My husband had gambled away the money, and we badly need money. The money lenders were knocking on the door. We couldn't even get out the door to get to our jobs. It was just impossible. I needed to make money. Did. But the woman whose baby I was carrying, or my baby, our baby, wanted us to be big sister, little sister. She came and visited. She wants me to be an auntie to the baby, up to the point I wish to be. And it was a really a beautiful thing. And for me, the big thing was this surrogate said, I gave the baby as a gift. In other words, it felt hers to give. It wasn't taken from her, wasn't already bought. It was hers to give. And in the opposite case, there was a Hindu surrogate who was employed by a Canadian Sikh family. And this family hired, what they required of her was that she go every day to a Sikh temple where the fetus could listen to the sound of the recitation of Sikh verses. And they hired a maid to, and at first the surrogate said, oh, this is amazing, I was a maid, now I have a maid, wow. But this maid was assigned the job of making sure she went to the Sikh temple so that the fetus could hear the recitation of the religious verses. And so here she was in this peculiar situation of being a Hindu woman carrying a Sikh baby. And the question arose, was the baby already theirs? They were treating her as if she were simply the receptacle of something they owned already. It wasn't hers, a gift for her to give. But at the very end, she said, well, but in private, when the maid wasn't looking, I said Hindu prayers to the baby. I thought, yes, good for you.
And that was one wonderful ending. And also some of the women really felt empowered. For the first time, they were valued by their mothers-in-laws. One mother-in-law said, I love you more than my son now because my son never brought in this much money. And that's really interesting because, you know, for a long time it was predicted that as the sex ratio became extremely skewed with a preference for boys, that certainly the value of girls would go up. And that wasn't happening. Women were abducted. They were shared among men. But apparently if you empower them economically, as Nick Kristoff also talks about in his book, then you really... you could really quickly change the perception of girls. So
yes,
that
yes.
Many of these Indian couples were saying, well, we want a girl. They're more reliable. They're more loyal. And that's really interesting.
But, you know, the question of where we draw the line is interesting with regard to surrogacy. Some people said, oh, I don't think we should have surrogacy because, you know, there are many children that need to be adopted, and what about adoption? Others said, no, no, it's fine to have surrogacy, but it shouldn't be commercial. Wouldn't someone from your church or community or neighborhood or your friend's circle to do it? And then another one said, no, you'd want to keep a little more distance than that, but why not do it with a nonprofit clinic like they do in England? It's a Great Britain solution to this. And then others said, well, no, it can be profit. What's wrong with that? So long, the place can be profit, the clinic can, but this particular surrogate shouldn't be. And another person said, no, she needs the money. What's wrong with that? She should do something to get that money. So it's fine for her to do it for profit. and it can be in the Henry Ford of a surrogacy context. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with that. But the man who said that paused, and then he said, well, it's fine for the first, second, the third, but if she does it four times, well, then she's becoming a baby machine. So everybody seemed to draw lines in different ways, but what that suggested to me is that we're confused on this issue. That technology has raced ahead, and our moral deliberations are way back behind that.
Yeah.
And if you look at the whole world, it's just very confusing. The communist countries forbid it, but do it anyway. The Catholic countries forbid it and generally don't do it. Protestants do. Israel does. and so there's a kind of a confusion on this issue as to where we draw the lines. What do we conceive of as personal and connected enough? For me, this is what became very important. I think we live in an increasingly unbalanced world. And what I'm doing in this book is trying to look ahead. Not everybody hires nameologists and wantologists and, you know, Indian surrogates, no. But I think that's the direction we're going, given this perfect storm we're sort of in the middle of, and that increasingly we're drawing lines. And what are these lines? They are ways of composing a self that is emotionally connected to a world we care about and disconnected from a world we don't. But we're always moving that line. And it's like we're regulating capitalism from the inside. We're kind of, because it's not getting regulated from the outside. Yeah. And that I think it's a source of malaise. Not the only source, but it's one reason that people sometimes don't feel attached in ways they expect to feel attached to what they're doing. They're alienated. And I think that's, if we can trace that down, it would be a good thing.
Well, I think this would be a great time to open it up to questions. Thank you so much, Arlie.
Yeah.
There will be mics going around the room, so just raise your hand if you want somebody to bring you a mic, and then...
Thank you very much. It's quite fascinating. I just wondered if you explored at all the introduction of robots into the mix, because in Japan, for instance, they're developing robots to take care of people in long-term care facilities, and just like to hear what you have to say about that.
Yes, they've been introduced in the United States, too. There's a robot called Daisy that is being tried out in the Alzheimer's wards and will come in. What's really interesting gender-wise is she's got little eyelashes that go up and down, you know. She's a girl. And we'll tell you what the weather's like today and what the date of the day is and when to take medications. Is it supplemental? Is it... or is it a replacement becomes, I think, a pretty important question. I actually, I think it was for the Los Angeles Times that I did an op-ed on the National Conference on Aging that's held. But this conference under George Bush, who was trying to cut all kinds of services, including for the aged, there was no talk of making good human care in nursing homes, but there was a lot of talk of robots, and the rationale for it was saving money. You know, well, we have to cut costs. And so I, if I were to think about this, I would want to very closely watch. I think fine for supplements, but is this being moved in instead of human face-to-face, voice-to-voice contact, which we know to be associated with good health, you know, and with high morale. Human contact really matters, I think.
Thank you. This question, I would actually be curious of both of your opinions about this. So at the end, when you were talking about attachment and sort of the malaise and almost entering from, leaving a sociological realm potentially into a psychological realm, I'm curious about how you think on, and I'd really be interested in the evolutionary insight into this as well, just to speak a little bit more about some of the psychological manifestations of this. And you talked about it again at the end about how it becomes this sort of inner line drawing in terms of deciding what one wants and how to connect to what's out there. But just, I guess, when there is that malaise and there is that deficiency and that connection isn't made in the ideal way, then how do you see that sort of manifesting in terms of just people's individual psyches as well as the social interconnection and fabric?
Mm-hmm. I'm always fascinated by that very juncture of the social and the personal, intimate. You know, I got a feeling that regardless of whether people bought a service or not, they had begun to conceptualize moments of personal life in a market-like way. In other words, by focusing on the purchase point, the perfect party, you know, the result, the thing you could take away, which in the case of a service is an experience, you know. So the result and meaning and joy was removed from all the little things you do, like blow up the balloons, send out the invitations, make the cake with your kid, that was not any longer kind of a source of joy and meaning. So that even when people weren't buying anything, you didn't buy the service, let's say, but you didn't sort of appreciate yourself for doing you didn't associate meaning with all the little moments of the journey. So that it was kind of a new kind of cultural recipe was being laid upon personal life, so that you focused not on the journey but the destination.
And I would say from an evolutionary perspective, we are really evolved to rely on other people, and we're an unusual species in that we pair bond, and that's pretty rare among the mammals. It doesn't mean that we're sexually monogamous, but it does mean we have a tendency to form particularly intense relationships. But that's taken on a whole new life of its own in relatively recent history, where that pair-bonded individual is supposed to mean everything to you in a way right. that it just never would have in the past. You would have had your friends and your kin networks and lots of other people to fulfill different niches. And also, this idea of the level of happiness that we've come to expect, I think, is really different than in the past. I was just rereading Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Committed, and she was talking about a woman in the 19th century from England who visited America and said, these crazy Americans expect every part of their body to be warm at once. It's kind of gone on there. Where are these expectations going to end for what it is that we think life should provide for us? But I do think it was interesting in your book that, you know, in a way, we're not as individual anymore. We're all a number six or a number seven. We can all be categorized in these different ways. And yet we're raising our children, this millennial generation. Every one of them is unique. Every one of them is special. The sky is the limit. They're good at everything. That's how I parented as well. I remember telling the author of a book on the millennial generation when he signed it, you know, to make it out to my son who's named for a bonobo. And he said, oh, how millennial. You know, he's special. He doesn't have the name that anybody else has. I think these are really interesting things, you know, how quickly our society is changing, and yet how some things we really can't escape, like that need for the real actual human connection.
But you know, it's the uniqueness, the millennial search for the perfect and the unique. I think that's something that's both some services vitiate and take away, like this love coach is telling his client, you know, you're a six, this is work, brand yourself, blah. So he's making her into a commodity in a way to get set for being one and then getting out, lifting out of the market. So he's depersonalizing her, but there are other services that repersonalize you.
That's true.
So there was a wedding planner who found just the symbol of their true love, and there was a lemon tree, you know, so there was a lemon tree motif on, you know, each card by the table setting for each guest, and lemons in the middle of each table, and lemons here and there. So it's sort of a branding of this personal thing, because nobody else in the world had this particular story of how they came together. So on the one hand, you're kind of depersonalized and, you know, turned into a six. On the other hand, you're this unique, you know, holder of a lemon tree.
Good evening. I actually was going to ask a similar question, kind of chicken and egg question, but since you've been talking about that, something different. Do you have a sense for when the tipping point came? I'm trained in history, and you know, I know that in ancient times, and even up until relatively recent times, a farmer might grow wheat, but then would take it to a miller to mill.
Sure.
There are certain things that you went to a specialist for,
sure.
But there were certainly a lot more things that you did yourself, and you certainly didn't arrange things as much with various services. When did things changeover? Is this something really recent in the past decade or two, or do you think that it began, you know, earlier in our recent history?
I was just having lunch with a historian, John Gillis, who wrote a wonderful book on history of the family in England, World of Their Own Making. And we were talking about when Valentine cards came in. You know, you used to do your Valentine's. You used to do a Valentine for everybody. You know, it wasn't just, and then it sort of through time came just one person that Valentine, you know, sort of a privatization of Valentine's, and certainly Christmas has had its long, long history and commercialization. The early Santa Clauses were really thin, actually, and small and elf-like, you know, and they didn't have that many toys, but it was this Sundblom was the name of this Finnish artist who was hired by Coca-Cola to do these illustrations that we think of as Santa. And he got fatter during the Depression. It was the 20s and 30s when people, you know, Santa was just blooming out, you know. And he was drinking a lot of Coke. So certainly there's a history to it, and you would know better than I. But I'm tracing here just something that I think's in the last 30, 40 years, that where and what's changed, not the existence of services, but who's doing them, and the fact that they're more specialized and have little pieces of expertise. They're more commercial in tone. Rent a friend, rent a grandma who will do your traditional cuisine. You know, rent a mom. So the language is more commercial than just 30 years ago and more global. So, yeah.
Consumers in the marketplace that you're talking about, I was curious, because it sounds like you talked with a variety of different people in the writing of this book. I was curious if there were commonalities in terms of the demographics of them, and particularly in terms of class, economic strata, race. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Great question. These were virtually all middle class, not although if you look at who's paying money for eating out, the poor eat out almost as much as the rich do. They spend virtually half of their income on food eaten out of the house, but they're eating at McDonald's instead of, you know, at fancy the Four Seasons or something. I wondered that question too. So I did a survey of California residents and asked them about their interest in services. Would you be interested in hiring a love coach or someone to put your family photographs together, a party planner, things like that? And what's really interesting is that as you go down the social class ladder, people become more interested in these services and not less. So the very people who can't afford it are the ones who want it more than the people who can afford it, more than the people that can't afford it. And so it's a kind of a paradox. I asked one question that was very poignant of answers. I asked, do you agree or disagree that you may not be able to count on family and friends, but you can always count on money to get what you need? Agree or disagree? And the farther down the social class you go, the more people agreed with that. In other words, we have a fantasy that the poor may not have money, but at least they have their mother-in-laws, their neighbors, their, you know, kin system. We think of Carol Stack's All Our Kin. That's not true. That the poor are poor in community, of helpful community, too. So that if we move, if it becomes the social status thing to do, to outsource your personal life and get it back in this laundered way we're talking about, that's going to cut the poor out doubly, because they don't have alternatives either to ways of meeting personal needs. So I think in this, the middle class is the one that's using these services, but it's the canary in the coal mine. And if it becomes that which poor people want, it affects poor people a lot, too. The alternative to that, of course, is to live in a balanced world where there are public services we can all enjoy with equal respect, and where there's revitalization of modern community, and we're not shunted into an everything-for-sale world.
You've been talking mainly about the demand side of this. Would you say something about the supply side? I mean, one of the things that's happened here is that people who supply these services have gone into these areas and not chosen traditional kind of careers. They may be more fulfilled as a result of all the opportunities they have.
They're extraordinary. I would say, as a whole, all the service providers I met were unusually gifted in social psychological ways. They were very good at what they did and took pride in it and loved their work. But you know, it's very interesting that often they said things like this. One woman who was a party planner, she played the guitar at upscale parties. She said, you know, I would give my right arm to play my guitar in children's cancer wards if only I could get paid for it. Another said she was a very gifted life coach. And she said, you know what I'd really love to do, what would give my life a lot of meaning, is if I could go to inner city schools and pick on some 15-year-olds, you know, and just take a track of 3 15-year-olds and make a difference, really turn them around. If only there were jobs like that. And they all agreed that if there were a job for the jobs that corresponded to social needs, there would be no problem in finding a job. But that's, again, I think a symptom. It's pointing to what happens to us when we live in a tilted system, you know, with the spheres of life are not in balance as we might want them to be.
Well, thank you, everyone, for being here, and thank you, Arla, for a wonderful work.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.